And we're off to the races, as it were. Hey, everybody, we're here today with the great David Cayley, who's been kind of a voice through which many people have met many remarkable thinkers at his time at the CBC and elsewhere. David was the first person through whom I encountered Ivan Illich a few years ago. We were just talking about that. And we might even just lead off with that article because you wrote that article, and I'll cite it in the I'll track it down and I'll put a link in the description at the beginning of 2019, but not the beginning, rather early in 2020, excuse me, 2020, when the events of recent years really began to unfold, and using Ivan Illich as a lens through which to construe and understand those events, he having been a very sort of almost prophetic, at least very prescient in his own analyses of the medical and other facets of our society. So, when you were talking about that article and how it has had a remarkable career.
Yes. Well, it came about simply through my puzzlement in the first month of the pandemic, so-called, when all sorts of things that I didn't understand were happening. All kinds of things that were unprecedented, but seemed to be widely taken for granted around me, such as that there could be such a thing as a lockdown, that it was wise to quarantine healthy people. And I couldn't, and it, the rationality of it all seemed to fall into place all at once, as I had observed before, for example, with 9/11, and earlier in 1975, I would say was another such moment when suddenly a new rationality seems to emerge full blown as common sense. And you think, but wait a minute. 3 months ago, this would have been a crazy idea within the public health, within the consensus of most public health professionals. This is so what is going on? Well, I had to go and talk to Ivan Illich because he has been my main teacher and advisor through the years, or through quite a few years anyway. So that's how that article came about, asking Ivan what was going on. And of course, I did find many predictions in his work. He wrote a book in 1975, 76. It got went through several editions, called Medical Nemesis, later called Limits to Medicine. And it called for what he termed a major health clean house cleaning in the health professions, but always within his leading idea, which was limits, right? That there has to be a limit drawn at some point, that you cannot live within a paradigm of continual progress because it's out of whack with reality, in which things go to a certain point and then go beyond that point and turn into their opposites. So he had recognized not long after Medical Nemesis had published and written about it 10 years later, that all that he had said in that book was premised on an idea whose idea had seemingly passed, which was that people could look on the medical system as a tool which was potentially within their popular or democratic control and change how that tool was defined and used. He recognized later that that was not the case, that this was an engulfing system in which doctors had become mere functionaries, and that its leading idea, its leading pathogen, he said, was the idea of health itself, the continuous pursuit of health or of some form of self-perfection. So he in his later writings, laid out a number of the things that I think came to fruition in the pandemic. One would be a society, for that, just to take one example, that lives by risk, that has risk as its, you might nearly say, leading idea now. And risk is self-estrangement in as much as it does not pertain to me as an embodied person. It's a characteristic of a population to which I belong, right?
Right.
So once I begin to speak about my risk, I identify myself with that, my doppelganger, as it were, the population David, who has certain characteristics that he shares in common with others. And then I internalize it as my risk, as if it were actually something somebody knows about me personally. So once that idea reaches a certain intensity, the pandemic policy, which to me was demonstrably ruinous, and I think we see the ruination all around us in broken lives and broken economies and, you know, small African countries that won't recover for 10 years from the imposition of a policy that made no sense for them whatsoever, right? For whom COVID was well behind tuberculosis, malaria, who knows what else as a real problem. And yet those societies were put into lockdown the same as we were put into lockdown. That's a rationality that came to fruition, in my opinion, over a 40 or 50 year period.
Right. Because see, there was this impression of a suddenness and this bizarre, wait, what was this just yesterday? You know, we were living with remarkable, quote unquote, normalcy, now that was all that normal. And then you have, as you said, this really, in my view, frankly, insane imposition of all sorts of measures. But in fact, it was not so sudden. The ground for that upheaval, that transposition, had been laid, and there's so much. So we could, one way I think it was laid is through this movement, as you said, to this emphasis on risk and risk analysis and what that implies for who and what we are as human beings. And you talk about that theme a bit. That theme comes up in your book, I think also Rivers North of the Future. But another thing that I might ask you about with reference to Ivan Illich and his analysis of what's occurring is the notion of the idol of life.
Yeah.
Right? Because there's the notion of health as a standard, but underneath it is this idea of life as an idol, IDOL, substantive life. And I think it ties into the question of risk analysis, because the individual becomes just sort of a vessel that is holding this substance, this life, this commodity, even if you like, that needs to be managed by society and so on and so forth, because life undergirds the system. And in this respect, I think there's a potential point of contact with another broad set of considerations to which we can turn momentarily, and that is the increasingly dominant role that the digital is playing or aiming to play in our society. I actually think there's a deep connection between this change in our relationship with health and life and our own bodies on the one hand, and on the other hand, an increasing reliance and an increasing sort of idolization of the digital. So to turn it back to you, and try to ask you like some point questions that, to which you can maybe respond. Could you say more about the notion of life,
I'd like to. I'd
how it
like to.
connects with health, and
Yeah,
then from there maybe we could turn to the digital or something else, right? But you can go
let's
through.
leave the digital aside for a moment. And in how to begin. Ivan Illich in 1989 addressed a convocation of Lutherans in Chicago. The lecture he gave is published in a book called In the Mirror of the Past. And there he told these this assembled group that he thought life was the greatest idol that the church had had to face in her entire history. A remarkable statement. But what did he mean? Well, to understand what he meant, you have to understand his overriding or his biggest idea, which is corruptio optimi pessima, the corruption of the best is the worst. He liked to say it in Latin because he was at home in Latin. And so the field, let's say, the aura of the word life is not understandable in Western societies outside of the declaration of Jesus of Nazareth that he is life, that he brings life, that he offers life more abundant. It's said in 100 ways in the Gospels. I am life, simply, without reservation. That's it. That's the gospel. So, life now, come ahead to our time, is a managerial, is a managed entity, right? You have the Department of Human Resources. Coke adds life. Life is there in so many ways as something of which we dispose, for which we are responsible. Every newscast is obsessed when trying to give an index of catastrophe with the death toll. You hear it the next day, the death toll has increased, as if more people had died. No, more deaths have been counted, more lives have been counted. We count lives, we manage lives, we believe we're responsible for lives. The pandemic was all about saving lives. The mayor of New York made an in no, was the governor of New York who made an insane statement about he didn't care how much damage was done as long if he could save one life.
Right.
It's on the scale of we had to destroy the village in order to save it. The famous, possibly apocryphal saying from the Vietnam War. But
Right.
so you have this, but life as this managed entity retains the aura of the Christian original. So it breathes sanctity, it breathes blessedness. So
It's
Ivan called it a fetish, a sentimental fetish. You could do by saying the word life, you can indicate at the same time two contradictory things, something you reverence and something that you intend to manage and hide the contradiction. So that was essentially what he meant by it. He got no hearing at all, really, in his lifetime on this point. And I myself, thinking that he was saying something of astonishing importance, dedicated a program outside of my other broadcast with him to this one theme of life as idol in 1992, and was amazed during a long career at the CBC when things that I broadcast generally achieved got some notice. Right? There was a response. This was the only thing I ever broadcast where I felt like it didn't get a response, as if it it didn't register. It couldn't be understood. It was somehow coming from somewhere else. And so he didn't get anywhere with it. But I think by the time of the pandemic, you could see that life, to put it boldly and maybe overly boldly, life is in a way the new sovereign.
Well, I think it ties into his analysis of how we become connected to and into systems, and then life holds on as a justification for the system, and the system justifies itself by appealing to the preservation of life. But as you know, it's a perversion of life as it's framed within the unfolding of the Christian narrative, because it's decentered. Ironically, it's decentered from the individual as an embodied locus, and it's also decentered from the divine, right?
Yes.
There's a little piece he wrote, and we mentioned this a little bit, right? Brave New Biocracy, Healthcare from Womb to Tomb. I find that just a very useful piece because he sort of spells it out there relatively concisely, mm-hmm. right? That you have, and there's lots of things that tie into this perversion, not the least of which is the advent or the ascent of the church. The church corrupts the Christian notion of life by trying to manage life, even manage grace. I don't know if the church tried to serve manage life so much as grace and hospitality and so forth, right? But then this administrative disposition becomes modulated again, modified, transmogrified with the onset of modernity, where you try and discard the notion of God, except very derivatively. Not that you actually do away with it, it's just sort of suppressed discursively. And you could say that the notion of life replaces the notion of God historically in this secular worldview, which then leads to all these bizarre contradictions, because it's now a worldview which is not necessarily, but often tied with, not perhaps in the most extreme expressions might be sort of the antinatalist and transhumanist expressions. But even though those are extreme, the notion that people should just stop having children and that we should be, you know, doing what we can to get rid of our bodies and live in a machine, they nonetheless are instructive, because they speak to this problematic shift into the abstract away from the embodied. Does that follow?
Yes. That's pure Illich.
But the thing is, it's a subtle
thing. Tom Lin, but it's pure Illich.
No. I mean, Illich really, influenced me markedly in his analysis, so I'm not claiming any originality there. I'm really making certain that I'm understanding Illich.
Yes.
But as you noted, it's a point which just kind of falls flat for most people. When I bring it up, they kind of look at you oddly. They're not like, I just don't think people kind of, you know, like Agamben has this phrase that the pandemic was, in a sense, Illich's moment of legibility.
Yeah.
But I don't know if it was a total legibility. This seems an aspect of his thought, which still, while I concur with it personally, I don't think it's quite yet assimilable by the culture at large. But why do you think that it kind of falls flat, that it doesn't get a hearing? Of course, I know that some people apparently can react quite indignantly when you suggested that life is an idol, but it's kind of a misunderstanding.
Well,
but
well it was a it
why
was
do
a,
you think it's not gotten more traction?
Well, I'll answer, but I just before, I mean, I think it was an interesting question for lots of people, and even maybe became almost a parlor game, why people divided as they did on the question of the pandemic, right? What were the characteristics? Because it cut across many existing differences, right? A
Yes.
telling moment for me was to see, I don't know if you know Max Blumenthal, who does a podcast called The Gray Zone, but whose background is certainly on the left, maybe not to give him labels, anarchist left, being interviewed by Jeffrey Tucker, who's a principal of the American Institute for Economic Research, a citadel of Austrian and libertarian economics, who founded the Brownstone Institute as a sequel to the Great Barrington Declaration, which essentially called quite moderately for a return to the former leading ideas in public health, right? But anyway, Tucker and Blumenthal are unlikely bedfellows, and yet they're expressing admiration for one another. So the left is the right. The right is the left. It throws all these categories up in the air, and I think it's really quite interesting. Well, that this new conjuncture is confusing and without names. I have a list by my desk here, it's a growing list, which I call Heroes of the Resistance, which are the scientists who are standing up and saying no. You know, whether it's Peter McCullough or Jay Bhattacharya or Harvey Risch, and these are names, I don't know if they'll be familiar to people who are listening to you, who have highly credentialed scientists who are saying, no, this is wrong, and this is an abuse of science. But where they're going to get to, how this is all going to come together, is at this point unknown. But to your larger question, why isn't this point recognized? Because I think fundamentally we don't recognize ourselves as a Christian society, which we are, according to Illich, right? So if he's right, he puts it in an epigram in The Rivers North of the Future, which is a book of interviews I did with him. When he says that modernity can be studied as an extension of church history. Well, let's say that he's right. Then all our modern institutions, from our derivations from an innovation that occurred within the Roman Catholic Church, first of all, and all are derived from the gospel, from the incarnation, from this turning point in human history, but which are then delved so deeply, buried so deeply, that everyone thinks we're over them, right? It begins with the Enlightenment, so-called. And Christianity becomes the scapegoat of enlightenment. Écraser l'infâme, says Voltaire, you know, squash the infamous thing, erase it. And people believe that they are without it. They have gotten over it. A Jew is still a Jew, whatever he or she believes. A Muslim is still a Muslim, or whatever he or she believes, but a Christian is not a Christian, right? People think They left that behind. So not seeing, if Illich is right, then you don't have any access to the unconscious foundation of your whole enterprise, right? And I mean, the woke, I don't like the word much because it's become a term of abuse, but it's convenient, it's at hand. The woke are a race of, undeniably, of, to me, of super Christians, right? But completely divorced from their inspiration. So what possibility of self-awareness if you can't recognize your inspiration, the source of your moral confidence? So I think we don't know the kind of society we're living in. We don't know how it came to be. We don't know the history that it's part of. And this, to me, is patent in Canada, and I think in the United States also, that we are actively disowning, erasing, dishonoring our history. Statues are defaced and decapitated, and we don't want to have any, we don't want to know, right? We're over that. Honk if you look deep. So that's a short answer. And I think Ivan put that premise forward, right? And
yes.
To that extent, and I think he felt himself to be somewhat alone. Part of my research, if you like, since he died, has been to discover that he was very far from being alone, that many thinkers have thought this way. My latest discovery is a German naturalized American writer, Eugene Rosenstock-Huessy, I'm just discovering and finding many, many parallels with Illich.
Right.
That's not the only reason he's of interest, but I mean, there, I found, you know, I felt that John Milbank and radical orthodoxy were walking a related path, that Harold Berman, various others, made me think that Illich was, in fact, part of a, let's say, an uncharted or unrecognized constellation in thought, which I think is still, you know, it's hard for it to come to attention.
Yes, I had an interview with Christian Roy or Christian Roy,
yes,
depending on whether you, and he talked about Eugene.
Did he?
You know, he has some pieces on him and his relationship with sorry, the tip of my tongue. Spengler. There's a kind of, as he refers to it, they were sort of intimate enemies, right?
Yes.
So that just to sort of echo that there are other people in that field.
I'm interested.
I'll try and send you a link to the interview in one of his articles.
Well, that would be good, yeah.
Also, I think Jacques Ellul, and I don't know as much about him, but Bernard Charbonneau, right? Sort of these, they're personalists. There's personalism. There's British personalism, French personalism, blah, 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 blah. Right. But, you know, so he wasn't actually perhaps as singular as maybe he felt, but it's difficult.
Well, he did. To be fair, my statement was extreme. He knew Jacques Ellul and paid tribute to him. He didn't think he was alone in that sense. But
also, you know, as you're talking, and this, we don't want to get too far afield, but with reference to the notion that we're fundamentally a Christian society, even though we don't confront that, it's not conscious, at least not adequately conscious in our self-conception. René Girard, does he not make sort of a similar assertion, though he comes at it from a different sort of direction than Illich would does, right? Doesn't he see, or maybe I'm misunderstanding Girard there, but you did several interviews with him and have some familiarity with his work.
Yeah, I think Girard, I think they have a lot in, I think they have a lot in common, and they have a difference which has been hard to clarify. Partly because they never, I mean, they did meet late in life, but I don't think anyone's really taken this up in a thorough way. But yes, they have an immense amount in common, which it might be hidden by the fact that Illich, as a critic, tends to emphasize the negative, right? The corruption of the best is the worst. Whereas Girard seems more even-handed. He says that after the incarnation, things will get better and worse at the same time. But he has room for the better in his thinking, and maybe it appears then that they have a different interpretation, but both essentially are apocalyptic thinkers in the sense that apocalypse means revelation, that the cat has been put amongst the pigeons. There's no way back. This eventually will declare its character, which is, you know, central in the gospel, right? That things I will reveal, things hidden since the foundation of the world, a saying that Girard took as the title for one of his major books. Everything hidden will be made known. So Illich's idea, so in a certain way, the saying at the end of Matthew's gospel, that the gospel will be preached to all nations, both of them in a certain way say that the gospel has been preached to all nations, but in this, Illich has perverted, corrupted form, right?
But maybe, is it so, that Girard may not see the developments as a corruption of Christianity, right? What you have with Christianity is a renunciation of the mechanism of the scapegoat, or the mechanism,
yes,
of a sort of sacrifice, which, yes, historically has a stabilizing function. So right, you forsake that mechanism of constraint, other things are going to follow, but you can't say that it's really a corruption. It's just the unfolding of the logic of what happens when you take,
yes,
your finger out of the,
yes,
dam.
That's right.
Whereas with Illich, it's the notion that it's a corruption. And I suppose the difference might be discernible if you tease out a little bit more. Why, for example, does Ivan Illich understand what transpired as a corruption of Christianity, as opposed to, say, with Girard, where it's not so much a corruption as indicating what was there underneath all along?
Well, Ivan says,
and the reason this might be a useful question beyond academic interest is it might help us come back to the question of how life arises as an idol, I think, but go on.
I'm not sure they disagree, but I can answer the question about why Illich regards it as a corruption, right? He takes the incarnation, the appearance of God in human form, as the offering of a previously undisclosed, unrevealed possibility, and one that had to be revealed, i.e., it wasn't within the human repertoire until it was revealed. And he takes the parable of the Samaritan as its paradigm, that the one who sees to the wounded man in the ditch is not his compatriots, the two priests who pass by on the other side, but is rather his enemy, the Samaritan from the northern kingdom, and to Judah and Samaria had been estranged to the point of violent enmity. It's the enemy who attends to him. So a shocking possibility is revealed. But Illich says in his research on the story that later this idea is domesticated as if this were a self-evident moral duty, nothing to see here. But he says, no, in fact, this is the ultimate scandal of the gospel, is to say that the enemy is the one who might step across this boundary to the other. But once that possibility is disclosed, the possibility of its institutionalization is created, right? So this singular act of movement towards the other, right, to be stirred in his guts, the gospel says, right? Paul says that he loves one of his correspondent in the bowels of Christ. It's the same word, the guts. To be moved in that way, once it's institutionalized, once it's brought under administration, right, something, Ivan has a whole series of words that he uses, wrong ones, guaranteed, right? It's once insured, you know, once that's brought under administration, and a power of love as law is created, which is unprecedented and will dramatically change the world forever, and is, in his understanding, I think, the gateway to the worldwide society in which we live. So we couldn't have got to this society except through this revelation. It wasn't in the human repertoire. People had taken care of their own. So that's the idea of corruption, right? Is what happens when the voluntary element, right, this opening is brought under management, under control, brought under law, in the sense that the revolution, all our legal systems go back to the canon law revolution in the Roman Church in the 12th century. And that, you know, sin is, Ivan says, criminalized, right? From a personal failure, right? It becomes an offense from which an institution can absolve me, or with which it can charge me. It's the beginning of a legalization that now runs so deeply into our minds that it's hard to understand the extent to which we rely on the law to make us good. So that's his idea of corruption. Now, does Girard have that idea? I think he does, but it's not developed in the same way. But he sees the cult of the victim in modern society. He sees how quickly scapegoating is reinstituted as the persecution of the Jews, right? So I think Girard sees what Illich sees, but doesn't frame it in the same way.
As you were speaking, it occurs to me you may have been away given an answer to the other question, or the I don't know if it was really stated as a question, but with the onset of the COVID event, let us say, there was this rivening, there was this sharp division that suddenly rose up between people, and intense difference. And you noted, is there a point of contact there between that divide which rose up on the one hand, and on the other hand, our relationship with the law or the administration, right? Because oftentimes the line of division was as to how appropriate would it be to like dissent from the prescriptions of these institutions that were issuing these constraints, right? To demur from those imperatives seemed to be a kind of litmus as to whether or not you're going to end up in one camp or another. I guess I'm just bringing it up because it strikes me that that's a potential reflection of the extent to which we have been conditioned to be administrative creatures.
Well, I think that's true. I think we need to probably guard against self-glorification, but I think that is true what you just said. And so, I mean, when you go, a lot of things, interestingly, predate, that are relevant to the pandemic, predate the pandemic. So they were already matters of concern, but they also show some kind of strange pattern, which I don't think you need to be a conspiracy theorist to see, that sometimes weirdly effects seem to precede the cause, right? That this is settling in as a whole. This new paradigm is settling in as a whole. So when you have the Trusted News Initiative begun by the BBC in 2019, which is, in a way, you can take it as a starting point for the misinformation or disinformation panic, the idea that there's the true information, which we adhere to, and there's these bad people who are spreading misinformation. There's a clear dividing line. We can even legislate, as Ireland has recently legislated, Canada is about to legislate. You know, we can state in law the difference between misinformation and true information. So the BBC begins that, right? But their idea is that they're going to stem vaccine disinformation. Vaccine misinformation, right? So it seems like what becomes the dividing line in the pandemic then is follow the true information, follow science, stay with the program. These bad people are spreading misinformation, they're spreading heresy. So the model of society that's in play is the model of a church, right? Aquinas says that the reason heresy is a capital crime is it because it tampers with the faith of the people, right? Nothing could be worse than to undermine the faith of the community. And I think that model's in play, right? So people, the ones who stand out, are willing to say, no, my primary allegiance is not to the scientific institution. My primary allegiance is to the scientific idea, right? So if, let's take a concrete example, Peter McCullough, a highly regarded doctor in Texas, looks and sees, wait a minute, there's a ban has been placed on all treatment of this disease until the vaccine arrives, right? He can't stomach that. He develops an early treatment protocol. And is vilified for that. So there are these people who step out of the institution and on some grounds of their understanding.
Right.
I think that is the dividing line, right? Whether your primary allegiance is to the institution, and that suggests that a panic was already well underway with the Trump election, with Brexit, and so on, right? A feeling of threat was there that made everyone want to adhere to these rituals, to the astonishing point that it didn't matter whether there was any evidence that masks were effective against respiratory viruses. It was hidden in plain sight that no randomized controlled trial had ever shown any efficacy because the ritual was so important, so necessary. This is the kind of people we are. My mask says, I love you, right? And your lack of a mask says, I hate you. Right. And that was the way it played.
I consider the mask to be, in some ways, the worst of the measures that were promulgated, because it played a role in, you know, stoking this division that we're discussing. But also symbolically, I find it just so repellent. I mean, this is just me talking. All right, this is me articulating that I consider them to be fundamentally antisocial and an expression of a hostility to nature itself, and a deference to a sort of an atmosphere of phobia. I mean, they disgust me. Okay, they disgust me, and to this day, I will still encounter people who wear these horrid face diapers, and. Now, of course, some institutions are trying to reassert the so-called mandates, and but I don't want to get pulled. I'm going to spin off here, right? But whenever they come up, I find them so revulsive, I can't right. contain myself. It's confrontational.
I have many neighbors who would not understand what you just said. They accept that you're pathologically antisocial. You care so much about your itty bitty feelings of independence and individualism that you can't get with the program and do the right thing for your grandmother. I mean, it's an amazing polarization of opinion.
Yeah, but it also indicates this sort of cultic adhesion to institutional imperative, because I'm just saying, why don't you just think through what's actually happening with these masks? You're not arresting, you're not stopping anything when you look into what's happening on a mechanical level. You're mitigating your oxygen uptake, you're creating a site for bacterial and toxic incubation, you're mitigating people's ability to understand what you're relaying emotionally by the obscuring of your face. These are things that are happening mechanically.
Yeah.
And do you not see how these things are in tension with a life of openness and love? Okay, so when you sort of prove me as a critic of mask wearing as being selfish, I'm going to say, no, actually, you're the one who is exhibiting selfishness because you're refusing to acknowledge, first of all, the enclosure and the atomization which you are abetting by wearing a mask, but you're also refusing to trust reality. Now that's the mask is a refusal to trust reality. The reality is that you as an organism are equipped to traverse your environment without the assistance of a cloth or paper foil on top of your face. You can do that. You can trust your own body to be able to work and through the world without that. And so there's a that lack of trust is fundamental to what's wrong in this situation from where I stand. Thank you for indulging me there on that tangent.
You're welcome.
But we should get back on track, right?
Yeah.
Because it there's this issue of a relationship with administration. Actually, I think the issue of trust is maybe one we could turn to, because why do we want to adhere to law, administration, so forth, right? There's a point of contact with the notion of risk analysis and why we want systems in place to mitigate our exposure to danger and safety and all that, right? What do you think is going on there? Is this an issue of trust, or what do you think?
Well, I'd want to make a proviso, and I mean, I cited the scientific research on masks, and in citing it, I implied that it has some importance, and so I can probably imagine a situation in which, if in a, in an emergency, it could be shown. I mean, quite definitively shown that masks were of benefit, I might take a different view than I'm taking now. So I don't want to make the issue of trust absolute, but I do think a major difference is what you're calling trust, I think, which is ultimately a question of what you think the nature of reality is, right? Do you think this is in some sense a created order? Do you think in some sense that peace is a something that is given to us, not something that we make. I mean, that would be a very fundamental way of defining the difference between what is given and what is made. Even if we don't know the source of the givenness, of the source of the giving, even if we're agnostic as to that source, which I think all modern persons to some extent must be, right? It would be hard to find even the most rigorous fundamentalist who really believes in the omniscience or the omnipotence of God in the way that someone might have 2,000 years ago. So whatever we believe to be the source, we feel that at the beginning, at the source is some sort of blessing, some sort of peace, some sort of goodness, which we acknowledge. I think that it does stand in contrast to the feeling that whatever order there is going to be is the order that we make And if we feel that way, then those who seem to be defying the order are very, very dangerous enemies, potentially, right? So
right.
There is a crisis. I believe there is an ongoing crisis of social order in the sense in which I just spoke. What do people think is at the source? Yeah. So I do think trust is in that way a fundamental question. And in what one trusts, right? If the source of our confidence ultimately is the institution, whatever institution it may be, whether it's the law or the school, if that's the ultimate source of our institution, we're going to feel very, very threatened, right? By those people who seem to be undermining the institution. And if we rest our confidence somewhere else, then we may feel freer and more confident, right? I never believed that there was a... I don't want to take the position of the pandemic denier. Obviously, when the new disease appeared, it was serious for some people. It was a real disease. But I never felt myself to be in a pandemic, and I was amazed that people around me were able to feel they were in a pandemic without any evidence. They didn't know anybody who was sick, and yet they were behaving as if they were in some sort of grave health emergency. The Prime Minister of Canada said it was the gravest health emergency in our history, which is just an amazing insult to all those who suffered from all the really terrible infectious diseases that plagued Canada over the centuries.
I mean, I appreciate your equanimity, right? Because I take a slightly, I do, I take a more adamant view. But this is, in a sense, it's moot. Whether the clinical nature of what transpired is, in a sense, moot. Whether it's viral or bacteriological or what have you, right? The more fundamental issue is our relationship with suffering and death and what the impositions of the state, etc., represent, was an appropriation of our authority over our own lives in that connection. So even if there was a raving upsurge of the bubonic plague, I would probably still take the stance that the extent of imposition was unwarranted. In part because, incidentally, if there had in fact been something on that order occurring, you would not need imposition to have people act in a way to mitigate it. No. The very fact of an actual pestilence in itself is more than sufficient to dissuade people from behaving in certain ways. The fact that you needed these measures is, in a sense, a demonstration that they were unnecessary. I actually think that they weren't just unnecessary. I think that they were very actively harmful on multiple levels. But anyway, the main point I want to raise here is that we should not become unduly detained by the clinical nature of the purported or asserted disease and correlative pathogen, because it's kind of a red herring. Whether it's a red herring from the standpoint of how are we going to relate with our bodies, our finitude, and so on. Is that the distinction I'm trying to draw clear, or
It's very
am I being...
clear. I think what I would probably agree and disagree at the same time. Certainly what you said about suffering and death, that was a huge part of what Illich argued in Medical Nemesis, right? Was that the reason for limits to medicine is because at a certain intensity, medical intervention begins to disable the capacity to suffer and the capacity to die. And that's a difficult statement for people to take in because each part of it is important. It happens at a certain intensity. This is not masochism. It says that that capacity is infinitely precious, to be able to suffer with dignity, to be able to find the moment of your death, which is obviously not given to all, is still something that those of us who are lucky enough to not be struck down by a Russian missile or whatever else may be around at the moment, is to find the hour of my death. That's taken away when the hour of my death is defined as the end of treatment, or actually when the doctor comes to execute me, as is now the case in Canada. So I agree with that. When you say that the clinic, what you call the clinical question or the scientific question, is a, you didn't say this, but can I say a triviality or a distraction? Then I say, well, I think it's going to be important to define the place of science in future societies. And to that extent, I am quite preoccupied with what is the state of the science, right? And how you can have, for example, the mask mania when you have had a 50-year campaign within biomedicine to establish what people proudly called evidence-based medicine. And the evidence-based medicine movement was firmly based on the idea that the gold standard is randomization, right? The procedure
yes.
by which, but the procedure by which you eliminate the possibility that the thing you're trying to understand has been caused by some extraneous factor. And we know that no randomized trial has shown a benefit in terms of blocking transmission of respiratory viruses. A big meta study for the Cochrane Library recently confirmed that. I can say that in many places in my milieu and be immediately taken not as somebody who is making a scientific statement that could be checked, but as an anti-masker. Oh, yeah, says my philosophy professor neighbor. Oh, I forgot, you're an anti-masker. As if that explained my stance rather than the evidence I just presented to her. So that's important to me. That seems to me,
well,
that seems going to be important.
I don't actually disagree with that. To clarify what I mean, right, when I say it is in a sense moot, is that I want us to have lucidity with reference to the specific propositions that we are contesting at a given moment. So it is not trivial whether a given behavior can contribute or derogate one's health status, right? Mitigate the transmission of a pathogen, things like that. That is not, that's a proposition that can be enumerated and then analyzed and has been in the case of masks, and the evidence which provided by such analysis is equivocal, to put it charitably.
Yeah.
And it's not mysterious that it's equivocal, because if you look at the proximal understandings that we have of, you know, just the behavior of gases and things like that, transmission of particles on a very small scale on a microscopic and subatomic and so on and so forth. When you look at what we understand of the mechanics of these processes, it's not surprising. It's not surprising, given our understanding of these mechanics, that something like a mask is not effective. In fact, if it was effective, that would be surprising. But we get into very interesting issues around evidence and around language, right? So you say evidence-based medicine, that, as you know, has been a movement, but it's a problematic movement, because the question is begged, who determines what evidence counts? And I hate to be cynical about it, but in my reading, the state of medicine in terms of the journals that count and the manner in which peer review actually happens is deeply compromised with respect to the selective criteria that are brought to bear in the selection and assessment of evidences. And it's a shame. This is just one example of how, just like you were talking about the Trusted News Initiative, you can't trust that, okay? They say it's worse than Orwellian. It's worse than Orwellian, because it's not simply an inversion. It's an actual indifference to the state of truth. And I would never have, if it hadn't been for the events of recent years, personally undertaken certain investigations regarding concepts that are considered in many circles as beyond question. Okay, but there are fundamental concepts, and I'm not saying that there's a definitive answer here, which have been held as simply demonstrated, which when you look into it have not in fact been demonstrated. The state of virology itself is highly suspect. Speaking personally, when you do your homework, that's the thing. So many people haven't done their homework with so many points. When you do your homework, you find out that far less is certain than you think is certain, right? I always bring up the notion of the phlogiston, right? Yes. The phlogiston was the theory of combustion that had some popularity from, I want to say it was the late 17th through the early, maybe a little earlier, 17th, 18th century, and educated people thought they were onto something. And in itself, it's not an outlandish proposition that there's a subatomic particle that catalyzes combustion processes. Then Lavoisier and some other people figured out how combustion works, and we forgot about the phlogiston. Right. Well, guess what? That's how the scientific process actually unfolds in a general way.
Yeah.
But as a consequence of understanding it's actually always motile, always on the go, always unstable condition, does it not follow then that we have to be extremely conservative in terms of how we attempt to integrate its findings into questions of policy and politic? Because the findings of science are always suspect on science's own terms.
I agree.
Here, I'm sort of following the recommendation of Paul Feyerabend, who says it's just the separation of church and science. So I'm sorry I went on there at a certain length, but
I think Feyerabend is probably good guide in some ways and not far from Illich on some points. So I don't disagree with anything you've said, really. I think.
But isn't it funny that you have people like your neighbors say, oh, you must be an anti-masker. So they're not listening to the content for your survey.
No.
If they were, right.
Yeah.
But go on. I didn't mean to, I interrupted you. I apologize.
But what was I going to say? The following science business in the pandemic was, to me, spoke eloquently of the disabling of popular judgment, right? So every politician in Canada announced that they were following science. But there was, in fact, no science. You can't have science of something that hasn't been studied yet and is, in fact, unknown. So, the inability, the disabling of popular judgment I believe there's always a difference and a tension between judgment and what can be known, what can be definitively known, if that's called science, right? And science is ever shifting, as you've demonstrated. It's paradigm dependent. It rests on certain philosophical presuppositions that are never acknowledged. So the new positivism, which is evident in the ability of politicians in Canada to simply say bluntly they're following science as if this were a known object, right? As if it didn't rest on any presuppositions, as if it were just a given, right? Is a deeply concerning situation for me, because it doesn't recognize that there's a sphere of popular judgment at all. It doesn't recognize that we need to reach, that we need to engage in moral reasoning, and we need to consider. There is nothing to, under on that reckoning, there is nothing to consider. Science will tell us what to do, right? So there's a deep, deep confusion about what science is and what it can confidently state and whether we should be guided by it, whatever it states. This simple statement that we're following science is apocalyptically wrong. And that's why I'm concerned about it.
Well, I think that underneath the key notion is disabling, right? The disabling function of institutions at large. I don't know if you want to elaborate upon that notion, because it shows up in many, many quarters, right? I think that is an acute, as you said, everything that happened spoke eloquently to the disabling of popular judgment. And then that actually holds in multiple registers, both in the register that there are policies that actively sought to assert that people were incapable of judging things with their own native intelligence. And on the other hand, in a way, many people have been deprived of the maturity of their faculties so that I don't want to say that they're incapable of affecting that discernment, but they are going to have a harder time than they should in affecting that discernment because of the manner in which our society, quote unquote, educates people. The vectors of education deeply compromise the celebration of our natural faculties.
Yeah, I would say, I mean, if we're talking about Illich and the ways in which he was, as you said, prescient, a book called Disabling Professions, which was published in 1975, I think, 76 maybe. He presents professional power, within which you would include the power of the scientific institution that we're talking about, as in effect a constitutional crisis, right? Because it basically reaches ever more deeply into the lives of people and tutors them in every respect. It teaches them how to feel. It teaches them what to feel, right? If you're grieving, well, there's a grief counselor on hand to show you how to grieve, and so on. So that was, yeah, a huge part of what he was saying was that unless professional power is limited, right, there will never be a rebirth of the vernacular, as he liked to call it, right, which within which you would include political judgment and the ability to reach your own conclusions, live your own, the communities and families and individuals living their own lives, right? And trusting their judgments. It's all, I mean, it's gone amazingly farther than Ivan wrote about in 1976, right? So the extent of socialization, if you like, is just quite remarkable now.
So I suppose I could ask you then, so as you know, like major issue of concern then for you is a more able sort of situating of the relationship between science discourses and political authority. I don't know if we've already said a lot about that implicitly. I don't know if you want to add to that, but then are there any other sort of major points which you see as of a special moment at this time?
Well, what you just summarized is certainly one of them, right? In the sense that, I mean, I participated as a broadcaster in several events in which I was brought up sharply against the limits to knowledge, right? The limits to science, you know, at a time when the maple tree decline, I'll take a concrete example, this is around 1989, was confidently believed to be caused by acid rain, but later that emerged as not the case, and nobody now remembers what acid rain even was. Or you could take the decline of the cod fishery in Canada, which was covered by my friend Dean Bavington in a book called Managed Annihilation, which was entirely done under scientific auspices, right? So there are many ways in which I have learned through my life of the limits to scientific knowledge, right? So yes, that's an important thing for me. But you know, I think the other, we've covered some other matters of concern too, right? Like the sovereignty of life. So I really, I mean, I take the pandemic as a decisive parting of the ways which is implicit already in so many ways, but it seems to me it really is a dividing line, in which one can see two societies diverging. And the issue there, therefore, for me, as a lifelong broadcaster and as somebody who's still interested in trying to finish a book about the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation and what role it might play, is that I really fear the civil discord more than anything else. I fear the growing antagonism, the growing incomprehension of two, and it simplifies to say two, but let's say two worldviews, which are neither very self-aware and which easily misunderstand each other. So when, for example, a famous instance, the trucker convoy came to Ottawa, and I think this was a sort of shot heard around the world in February of 2022, I guess it was it? Or 21.
It all gets a bit blurry.
I mean, it was evidently a profound eruption from the Canadian political unconscious. It was an amazingly impressive political manifestation. At least it amazed me that these folks could get those big rigs going in the middle of the winter, put their livelihoods on the line, organize this event, which brought people out all over the country to greet them and cheer them on bridges and in parking lots along the way, that they would arrive in Ottawa. The government would treat them as social enemies, not as a new incipient public to be somehow addressed. And the CBC would also treat them as social enemies, and in fact, never talk to any of them, never have anything to do with any of them, treat the whole issue as a blight, right? Something to be denounced, contained, moved out. It's deeply alarming to me because, first of all, whatever you, enemies become more like one another. The longer their enmity persists, the more they become like one another. And these people who, had they been heard and had their position, which was not on an unreasonable position, they were opposing vaccine mandates, been entered into public discussion, then a lot of good could have followed. But once they're pushed aside, once they're scorned, legally prosecuted, all the rest, then their position hardens, right? And positions are hardening as we speak, right? And I find that really quite frightening. I'm a very old man, and more as it pertains to my grandchildren than as it pertains to, or my children than it, as it pertains to me. But I find it, yeah, very, very frightening. Yeah, so I think peace has to be, peace is the cause I would like to speak for finally.
Peace. Yeah, I mean, your remarks chasing me in part, in virtue of that, I have developed such an intense sense of enmity, not for particular people, but for, let's just say, short hint, for the system, that I despair at times, right? It's important to remember the humanity of everyone in the fold, right?
Yeah.
So I I welcome that correction.
Well,
A
my assumption.
possible no, possible. Sorry, go on.
Well, we. I mentioned my debt to Ivan Illich. We are speaking about him, so let's bring him in as an example. There are certain things that I'm not sure I would ever have understood for myself that I feel I understood through him. So a teacher, in that sense, is a bridge. And there are certain things, and in a way, it can be an analogy of what I said about revelation earlier, not that there are things that perhaps we would not have, could not know with our unaided faculties, things we can only reach by faith, let's say. But I think it follows from that that everybody has been bent in a certain way by circumstances, by they're neither responsible for what they think nor unresponsible for what they think. It's more complicated than that. They're both. So people get into positions, right? So I take a certain view of the convoy in Ottawa, and my cousin tells me recently that she has a friend who was working at a restaurant, and a group of people came in and tore the mask off her face and frightened her and rocked her car and alarmed her. So she can easily take the view on that evidence that these are thugs, right? Or she had a blind friend who was frightened by all the noise, who lived in downtown Ottawa, who was frightened by all the noise and the pollution of the truck engines and all the rest. So people take a step, and then that step leads to another step, and that step leads to another step. And pretty soon they're in a position, and the others are in another position. And then, you know, one step at a time, the war begins. So I think an agency, a public broadcasting agency like the CBC, is one of the institutions that should address that, that should try and at least create a ground for mutual understanding, right? And what has happened instead is that the CBC has ended up as a partisan, right? It's completely, right. having expressed my reservation about the word, I'll say they're completely on the woke side of this social divide. They're partisans. They're not peacemakers, and they should be peacemakers.
This is a circumstance that has been on the way for a while. That, I mean, I think it's a question as to whether at any point journalism as an institution was impartial. But there are degrees, and it seems that there has been a remarkable deterioration. I would say from maybe the mid-90s forward. That even might be a generous characterization. You know, here in the U.S., I can't even stand listening to NPR, National Public Radio, because it itself is, as far as I can tell, pretty unapologetically just a voice of hegemony, to use a fancy pants word, right? The elite,
yes,
factors of society, and so for, you know, from where help can be drawn, though, is that despite that occurrence, they don't have as much influence as I think we want to believe that they have. And this is because people have actual lives. There's the stories that are told by the CBC or the BBC or NPR or whatnot. And then there's the fact that people have actual lives. And there's an actually remarkable divergence there between the narratives which are being foisted upon us, and then what happens when we like get out and get in the world and actually interact with people. And when you do the latter, generally things go pretty well. Now, I'm not dewy-eyed about it because that's not always the case. All right. But bottom line, people actually want to get along with each other. So incidents right. even like that described by your cousin are anomalous and also ironically articulate a frustration on the fact that we're not being allowed to get along yes. with each other.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. I mean, that's what a riot is. It's like people just want to lead their lives and they're frustrated with not being able to lead their lives. And so it gives rise to this very problematic situation, right? And kind of like breaks one's heart, you know, because you're sort of feeding into the very hands that you're trying to resist. But anyway, the main point is to go on.
Well, you raised the question of whether journalism was ever impartial. And my answer to that would be no. But as you said, there are degrees, right? And but I don't want to say let's go back to the golden age of the CBC in the 1940s or something or 50s. I want to say let's step into this breach and make peacemaking our aim. Yeah, I think, but that doesn't mean there are not useful things in the past to recuperate. If anyone was interested in the past, there are, but I would never, I think the general social mood is certainly is one of profound reaction in the sense that the Trusted News Initiative and its ilk are positing a time when we could trust the news media, right? Or the follow science position is, you know, looking back to a golden age when, you know, everyone trusted science, you know, let's say. Or, you know, I have no sense of going back to some great good time. I think what we're in the first place is a media revolution on a scale that I don't know what's comparable to it, but you would certainly have to go back to the invention of the printing press to find an event that had a similar social impact as the turning of every single every single smartphone user into a broadcaster, into a center of, I mean, it's unprecedented, right? You know, you can't, there is no simple characterization of the internet that is possible. The internet is what you and I are doing, and it's a lot of other things as well. And the people are trying to, but it's certainly true that people are trying to think for themselves. That's one of the things that's going on. And the misinformation idea is basically, to me, let's try and stamp that out, right? Let's stop this plague of people thinking badly, as always implied, for themselves, and get back to authoritative opinion, which is elite opinion, which is take the vaccine and shut up. So I think it's a challenge that can't be comprehended or easily imagined even. It is a very new circumstance. So
it's where as the Buddhists say, we're in the bardo. We're in this state of you never escape the bardo with transition. You know, we're always in a transitional condition. Eric Coppolino, I don't know if you're familiar with him or not, but he has this point in terms of sort of foregrounding how something has qualitatively shifted, and that this is a contrast between 1969 and what happened in 1920. What happened in 1969? You had the Hong Kong flu raging, front page New York Times, whatnot, so on. 100,000 people apparently killed or died from that, succumbed to it. And then you had Woodstock in the same moment.
Right.
And he reached out to the organizers of Woodstock. Some of them knew about this. It was like common knowledge. They didn't care, right? People went and all sorts of things were going on in 1969. The world didn't grind to a stop because of an upper respiratory infection.
Right.
So what happened between then and 2019-20? And that all of a sudden you have apparently an upper respiratory infection that actually ground the world to a stop. And what happened, he would suggest, is the digital, right? And that's right. So there's this remarkable sea change, and we're in the middle of figuring that out because we can't throw the baby out with the bathwater and just, you know, say like, well, we have to go back. But this is perhaps where the council of limit sort of presents itself as advisable, if never easily rhetorically exciting.
Well, that's an interesting point you just made. Yes, I think the element of renunciation, of limit, is absolutely crucial, because people are crazed by this development, amongst other things, right? They're made mad. They're destabilized to such an amazing extent by this constant, like, communication becomes an illness, right? And I'm sure there are many people practicing this renunciation, right? Cultivating silence, cultivating withdrawal, cultivating thought. But generally, I can't see how you can deal with it without limits. Yeah.
I mean, it has to, I think I don't like being a wet blanket, but in part, I almost feel that I want to resist people's enthusiasm about certain phenomena. So the appeal to language generation software, so-called ChatGPT and all that, right? I think that this is actually a really fundamental thing where we should just say, hey, no, just cut it out. Because what are you really doing here? What are you really doing with this approach to language, handing it over to a recursive stochastic algorithm? You're creating a condition of erosion, but people get very excited about it, and I don't want to be like, oh well, you know, I don't want to steal joy from people, but on the other hand, I think people fail to appreciate their capacity to realize joy without a phone in their hand. It may sound very, I don't know, whatever.
Well, no, I think it's true. There are things that Like, I don't think ChatGPT is very important. The fact that
No,
it
it's
can
just
write,
an
if it
example.
can write a better essay than some students, that I don't care. The students have to learn to write the essay. So yeah, I certainly agree that these things are given an importance. If they were not given the importance they're given, they would appear differently. It's an, and then there needs to be a judgment needs to be exercised and reached. Say no, we don't care about this. This is not what we want. We don't. So I think we need to bring this to a
Yeah,
conclusion. We may be
right.
over.
Well, I thank you for your time. I'm sorry if I held you on there. Let me just ask you, do you have any other sort of concluding point that you'd like to append before I
I
jump off
don't
here?
think there's anything that I haven't said that I would want to add. No, I'm glad to meet you. I'm glad to talk about these things.
I'm glad to
And
meet you as well at a distance, so. So thank you so much.
do send me the information about Christian Roy.
I will do
And
that.
this interest in Rosenstock Hussey is I'm glad to know I'm sharing it.
So I'll do that. I'll do that when we get off here in a few minutes. Thank you again. And then I'll send you up, we'll put it up and so forth right now. Link to your website. So thank you so much for your generosity, Dave,
You're
or
most
David.
welcome, Tom. All the best to you.
Have a good afternoon.
Bye bye.
Bye.